You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello and welcome to this podcast, Assessing the Future of Therapies in Development for Limb-Girdle Muscular Dystrophy, or LGMD, the Role of Genetic Testing. In this episode, we'll discuss how genetic testing can be incorporated into the diagnostic process for LGMD. My name is Vaidehi, and I'm thrilled to host today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Matthew P. Wicklin, Professor of Neurology and Vice Chair for Research at the Department of Neurology, UT Health San Antonio in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome, Dr. Wicklin, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into genetic testing, can you tell us a little bit about LGMD subtypes? Is the fact that there are so many subtypes, does this play a role in the requirement of genetic testing in the first place?
Absolutely. In terms of the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies, there are probably 35 to 40 of the named limb-girdle muscular dystrophies that have an LGMD nomenclature assigned to them. But in truth, we've talked about that there are a number of different genes that can lead to the same phenotype. So there is substantial genetic heterogeneity in terms of the phenotype, which is proximal weakness affecting the shoulder and hip girdles. And when you look at it, when you consider all of the autosomal dominant and recessive limb girdle dystrophies, the distal myopathies, the Emery-Dreifuss muscular dystrophies, the myofibrillar myopathies, metabolic myopathies, dystrophinopathies, and other genes, it winds up being close to 200 to 300 genes that can lead to that proximal predominant phenotype.
I believe there's a new nomenclature system for all these subtypes as well. Can you briefly tell us about that?
Absolutely. Our previous nomenclature, which was around for 20-some years, included using LGMD1 for dominant and LGMD2 for recessive. And then a letter was added delineating the order in which the chromosomal locus was discovered, such as LGMD2A would be calpainopathy, and that was the first of the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies with a chromosomal locus delineated. LGMD2B was dysferlinopathy, and the problem we had is that we ran into a lack of letters. We got to LGMD2Z, and then the question was, what should we do? And so the new nomenclature came out in 2018 from the European Neuromuscular Center. They had one of their meetings, and they redefined the nomenclature such that it would be LGMDR for recessive and D for dominant. And then it talked about the order of gene discovery that received a number, and then it delineated the affected protein. So what previously for calpainopathy was LGMD2A became LGMDR1 calpain 3 related. And just to expand just briefly on that, muscle disorders have undergone quite a bit of change in terms of the different ways that we name them. We started in the old days with eponyms, meaning Duchenne, Becker, Emery-Dreifuss, etc. And then we moved on to using muscle biopsy histology to describe muscular dystrophy, central core myopathy, Nemelin myopathy, myofibrillar myopathy. And then we also have used phenotype, so whether that be limb girdle, fascioscapulohumeral, oculopharyngeal. And then we name things by the protein, such as dystrophinopathy or calpainopathy, or by the gene, such as DMD or RYR1 related. And now, for the LGMDs, it's useful to use this nomenclature that is the new nomenclature, which would be something like LGMDR1 calpain 3 related for calpainopathies.
That's very interesting. Moving on to the diagnostic process, how would you go about diagnosing an LGMD?
This has changed substantially in the last decade. In the old days, we would do history, physical, lab testing, biopsy, EMGs, and things of that sort, and then ultimately tried to find a single gene that we would test. However, that older paradigm for testing is really not very valuable as we move forward, because there's a higher yield by doing different testing than single gene testing at one time.
You mentioned genome testing or exome-wide screening. Why wouldn't we start by, you know, doing that instead of targeted genetic testing?
Vi, your question is very good about genome or exome sequencing at the start. So in terms of not using that at the start, it is used in the pediatric setting as the initial genetic testing. But on the adult side, the main reason for not going straight to exome or genome sequencing in the past 5 to 10 years has been the cost, challenges with insurance approval, difficulties in ordering the tests, and long timelines to getting test results back.
Okay, so basically it's the cost that's prevented people from going in for genetic testing, and that's why they are not being routinely done.
Cost and the timeline has been a challenge. Currently, we use a lot of, on the adult side, panel testing, and panels consist usually of 100 to several hundred genes, and the yield of panel testing is much better than single gene testing, and the yield is not nowadays quite as good as exome or genome sequencing, but the ease nowadays of getting panel testing has been much easier with the number of sponsored programs that are available in the United States for testing. The other advantage of doing broader testing is nowadays we're starting to find patients who don't quite fit the typical phenotype for the gene that we think they might have. And the reason for that is we're finding that they have double or triple trouble, which means they do have more than one disorder, and that's why they don't look like the typical phenotype.
Okay, so earlier in the diagnostic process, you mentioned you go through a variety of tests before you reach genetic testing. Is there a new paradigm that you think might work better? Should doctors be encouraged to refer all their patients for extensive genetic testing?
Vi, that's a very valid point. There is a new paradigm for doing genetic testing. In terms of evaluating patients who have a limb girdle pattern of weakness, if you do your history and examination and you feel as though that patient likely does have a genetic muscle disease, a limb girdle muscular dystrophy, it's reasonable and now cost-effective with panel testing to move straight to genetic testing with either a panel, an exome, or genome sequencing platform. If that doesn't give you an answer, then it's very reasonable to circle back to laboratory testing, EMGs, imaging, and biopsy. And if that still doesn't give you an answer, you can reach out to do further testing, such as metabolomics or proteomics or RNA sequencing. And in my mind, in the next few years, the newest paradigm will be that there will be genome sequencing done at birth. And interestingly, the NIH has a push to have this become a reality, since that will help propel forward personalized medicine platforms that they're working on.
That's really interesting. So, Doctor, what steps would one take if genetic testing were negative or equivocal?
Yeah, so there are times where you don't get an answer or you get a variant of undetermined significance. Most importantly, I think you should make sure you're not missing an acquired and treatable disorder. So we now know that HMG-CR antibody myositis and anti-SRP myositis and some of the other myositis antibody disorders can have indolent progression over many months or several years and look like a genetic myopathy, genetic muscular dystrophy. And so it's important to make sure you test for those because there are treatable and reversible disorders. Additionally, you can do further genetics looking at the repeat sequence disorders, such as myotonic dystrophy, FSHD, or oculopharyngeal muscular dystrophy. You can, if you've not already done so, move to genome sequencing. And in the future, the next several years, we're going to be moving to long read genome sequencing. And long read genome sequencing will be able to pick up even more diagnoses. You should consider that there are some disorders now that we know are multigenic in their mode of inheritance. There are at least two of those that have been published. And then it's also important to make sure that if you don't get the right answer, you work a little bit to try to get that answer by trying to get variant resolution or confirmation. And you can do that by evaluating other family members that may be affected with the disease. You can do RNA sequencing or proteomics. And then you can also do ancillary testing. And an example that we had from several years ago was a patient who we thought had VCP-related myopathy, which can present with a limb girdle pattern of weakness. And in that patient, there was a variant of undetermined significance in VCP or valacin-containing protein. And that patient had further testing, which helped us because in patients with VCP, they sometimes have Paget disease of bone, and he had an elevated bone-specific alkaline phosphatase. And then we looked at the pattern of muscle involvement on his MRI, and his pattern of muscle involvement on his MRI of his thigh was the same as that which is seen in VCP. And ultimately, 2 years after we made the diagnosis in him, he had finally been confirmed to have a diagnosis once his VCP variant had been confirmed to be pathogenic.
Okay. I think we have time for a case study, Doctor. Would you be able to share a case study with our audience?
Absolutely. So we have a gentleman who was, at the time we met him, a 20-year-old gentleman who presented with persistently elevated creatine kinase levels. Interestingly, at 24 to 26 years of age, he was a 6'5" tall, 305-pound professional football defensive lineman. At age 27, his chief complaint was that he lost his explosiveness when he was trying to accelerate off the line of scrimmage. He sought evaluation for this and was found to have some elevated AST and ALT levels and a CK level of 8,000. He was then hospitalized for this elevated CK level, and he was given IV hydration because they thought it was rhabdomyolysis, and then outside providers put him on prednisone for polymyositis. We saw him several months after that at the age of 28. And at that time, when we looked at him, we just started over and took his history and decided where we were going to go. So he was an exceptional athlete in high school and college, which does fit with a couple of the limb girdle muscular dystrophies. There was no family history of related muscle disease. He had used supplements that perhaps might have caused him to have more challenges. And he did have slightly low testosterone levels, which we thought was a red herring. When we initially examined him, his strength was still phenomenal. He had elevated CK levels that were in the 1 to 3,000 range. And we did a number of tests in terms of lab tests and echocardiogram to see how he was doing. But we ultimately said, this looks like it could be a genetic muscle disease. And when we reevaluated him, he had difficulty standing on his toes, which made us think about two disorders, dysferlinopathy and anoctaminopathy. And so we decided the next step in his evaluation should be genetic testing. And so we moved forward with panel genetic testing. And on that panel genetic testing, we found that he had two pathogenic variants in dysferlin. And importantly, this helped us in terms of his diagnosis, because in dysferlinopathy, patients often have difficulty standing on their toes early in the course. And also, it's well known that they can be athletes that are superior to their peers.
Oh, that's a really interesting case. How's he doing now?
At the current time, he's had his weakness progress somewhat. He's having difficulty traversing stairs. He cannot walk on his toes at all. But very nicely, he's the proud father of two children at this time. And he has transitioned to non-football life and being successful out in the community. The big challenge that we've had with him is that without doing genetic testing, it would have been a long haul to get to that diagnosis, whereas doing genetic testing upfront helped us to get to the diagnosis within about 6 to 8 weeks.
Thank you so much for that, Dr. Wicklund. That's all the time we have for today. I'd really like to thank Dr. Wicklund for taking the time to speak with us about the role of genetic testing in the diagnosis of LGMD. And thanks for our audience for joining us. We hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. There are a total of two. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Sarepta Therapeutics, Inc., who provided an educational grant for this activity.